Okay, please take your seats. If I can ask everybody to reconvene. And I'd like to ask Larry and Dirk to join us up here, along with Emmy and Greg, who I'll introduce in a minute. I know that was a quick coffee break, but particularly wanted to reconvene in order to have our guests who are online, our panelists overseas, who are joining us, as I mentioned earlier. And I will turn to first, I'll introduce each of them before they give about a 5 to 7 minute response to the presentations this morning. But first we have Bill Hammack, who is furthest away in time zones as our mission director in India. I had the pleasure of working with Bill when we both served in USAID Russia, but Bill has an incredibly rich career, as many of you know, with more than 30 years in USAID and in the Senior Foreign Service, one of our career ministers currently leading the mission in India. Prior to that, he was our mission director in Sudan during an incredibly important and historic time in that country's history, as well as in Ethiopia, and then has led several bureaus, the transition with the former EGAT Bureau, which we now call E3, and has served in Dacha, as well as in serving in many missions around the world. So I think we have Bill online. I'm looking back at our technical specialist. So on that note, I will turn it first over to Bill for a response and maybe some provocative questions that he wants to throw out. Thank you, Bill, for joining us. Bill?
Hello, can you hear me?
Wonderful, we are connected. It sounds like the voice of God.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, perfect. Thank you for joining us.
It was working fine before. Okay. Good morning from Delhi. It's great. Okay. Good morning from Delhi. It's great to be part of this Experience Summit, even though I'm half a world away and it's getting quite close to being pretty late. I appreciated hearing the presentations from Larry and Dirk, and of course reading some of the documents developed for this summit. We'll definitely organize a roundtable here with our staff to review and discuss these papers and discussion. I'd just like to share a few thoughts related to strengthening country systems and some of the words that Dirk and Larry threw out there as well, but based on experiences here in India, where USAID has been working nonstop for over 50 years. So some of what I say will be relevant for not all countries, but for quite a few. First, Dirk mentioned strengthening by responsibly using country systems. India is in a position where India itself pays for poverty reduction programs. Senior Indian government officials have told us they don't really need our money. What they would like is targeted technical advice with global best practice reach back to strengthen their existing multi-billion dollar national programs, such as the National Rural Health Mission. So that really raises the question when Dirk talks about use of systems or strengthening systems, is targeted technical support to strengthen massive country-led health systems, for example, using those systems as well as strengthening them? I say absolutely. The success of the systems is the success of the technical support. And also, in the last several months, I've taken part in closeout events of programs that, in fact, USAID has supported for the last 17 years and another one in the last 20 years. I think in India, because we've been here pretty consistently for so long, we have these kind of very long multi-decade programs. For both of these institutional support programs, USAID carried out impact evaluations to try to look at the evidence. Some of the findings, can Larry stay the course? A lot of this is really long-term commitment, establish clear objectives up front, keep flexible and overall setting often, and be ready to change continuously. the need for consistent leadership is key, and of course not just host government leadership in this case, but also USAID leadership. And make sure new instances are viewed as country system and not just USAID-built institutions somewhat outside of the system. That's one of our problems right now. While these types of lessons learned might be relevant in other countries, and I hope other aid missions do read these impact evaluations, given the current context in India, we're no longer looking to support long-term institutional development programs. We're really looking for more turn-on, turn-off approaches like DIVs. Another point related to country system strengthening, this past year we made a major effort to work through Indian organizations as implementing partners in a range of programs, especially targeted technical support, as I mentioned. USAID India carried out 11 separate pre-award surveys before signing our project instruments, and we found problems with all but one of the organizations. Upon drilling down in a systematic way, we found gaps in even well-known Indian NGOs. We worked out ways to move forward while putting in place support and oversight from our support teams, including six-month financial reviews. The lesson learned, while we appropriately focus on working through capable and technically sound country-based NGOs, it's not nearly as smooth as we had thought, and it does and will require continued support on building internal systems within those NGOs. Third, USAID needs to look beyond the typical and normal country development partners and systems. Soon after arriving in Delhi, now with a really an upfront senior government official who had worked on and off with USAID and what USAID's working in, and he looked at me as he has here, but more legacy than current action, with USAID preferring to, quote, stay in our comfort zone, unquote. Well, that was a bit of a kick, and it was welcomed. We reached way out of our comfort zone, meeting with Indian billionaires, socialists, barefoot colleges, new entrepreneurs with great ideas looking for seed funding. Country systems, but have shifted not only focus, but our horizon. We're now focused on strengthening the overall ecosystem in India related to identifying, supporting, and scaling Indian development innovations, both in India and globally. Working closely with Indian and international partners and with a focus on Indian social investment capital. Clearly, country context is key. But related to that, we need to continue to look for that country system where we get more development bang for the buck, meaning, as Larry said, faster results and lower costs, and increasingly looking for new systems and partners in many countries, such as India, and I would also suggest Kenya as an innovation lead, where the country system that we would be focusing on, for example, is around development innovations focused on the poor. We might want to think in different ways about country systems and system strengthening, not just about G to G, which I kind of thought Dirk was focusing on, but about working on systems with all partners, especially those with capital. As we say here, money on the table, and of course with common development objectives. This also means co-design approaches, where USAID is not viewed as a funder, but as a partner, also bringing money and ideas to the table. And finally, just a few other random thoughts as I talk to some of the other folks here on this important issue. I've heard capacity building described as a supply-driven bottomless pit, so hard to measure results. I'm sure there's other ways to look at it. Our middle initial here is simplify, keep it simple. The systems and relationships in India are complex enough. And finally, what we found across the board is incentives matter. As several of the papers mentioned, we really have to work at figuring out the incentive structures with what we're dealing. Thanks a lot, and I look forward to hearing the rest of the panel.
team staying up late and, as always, working very hard out there in India. That was incredibly useful to hear some of your thoughts and your perspective from India. I'd like to turn now to our mission director in Ghana. We are so fortunate to have Cheryl Anderson, I guess maybe, I don't know, 5 hours in time zones away from us to join us. Cheryl's had an incredibly rich career in Africa. Many of you have followed her. Not only is she our mission director in Ghana, but it was our mission director as well in Kenya and has a long career having served in Uganda and many other posts in Africa. So please, Cheryl, share with us some of your thoughts to the panel and the audience.
Hello from Accra. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, thanks for including me. Great presentations and really thoughtful background papers. I wanted to make a few comments on the presentations, and then I'd like to get more specific on what can be done based on our experience here in Ghana, and then I'd like to talk about what I see as some of the additional challenges and how we should deal with them in our policy. So just regarding the rationale for strengthening country systems, I think there are two very practical reasons that need to be included. First, thinking broadly, I'm in a country, fortunately, where we can and we do think about aid independence in the future. And so a successful path to that independence where we can begin to exit really depends on strong country systems. And then more narrowly, as we are committed as an agency to localizing our aid in our IPR and to using country systems in our global aid effectiveness commitments, I think to be able to use those systems and to have direct relationships with local institutions, we need strong country systems. Let me just talk about some of our experience here in Ghana, where, as you probably know, we have a relatively responsible government, and yet some of the critical host country institutions and systems still need strengthening for Ghana to be able to deliver development effectively to the people. We're working on strengthening country systems in every sector, and we plan to continue that in our 2012 to 2017 country strategy. We have been doing it with a mix of technical assistance and direct assistance, and in our CDCS, which is our country development cooperation strategy, we'll have a shift to more direct relationships with local institutions, but technical assistance will still be needed for sure. Some of our biggest wins, I think, have been in getting behind Ghana's development plans in the sectors where we're active and strengthening the systems there. For example, in decentralized local governance over the last few years, we've been focusing on one of 10 of Ghana's regions, building up the key capacities in select districts, and then building the citizens' ability to interact with their local government and hold it accountable. And now those 5 districts have produced their own medium-term development plans that include the technology of spatial planning, and now they're integrated into the Western Region's medium-term development plan for 2014 to 2017, and that feeds up into the national development agenda. Another example is in health, where we're working with regional health directorates on strengthening their systems for the last 3 years or so, including training and processes, policies, leadership, incentive grants. And we've seen improvements already in service delivery in those 3 regions where we've focused our efforts, including in the number of skilled deliveries, in family planning updates as well. And then in education, another angle, we decided that the Ministry of Education, along with us, we could really be helpful in modernizing the ministry. They were really dealing with 21st century issues and opportunities in a 19th century system. A little scary to jump into that, but we have become a catalyst and a funder and an advisor on instituting a new electronic internet system for communications and data management in implementing the country's development strategy for education. So I would also mention that we're working more broadly in collaboration with other donors on areas like public financial management and audit. These are more challenging, partly because it's harder to see quick results, but I think they're essential. I think the conclusion that we've made in the absence of a policy is that it's important to look at what are the key institutions in the systems for the achievement of our own development objectives, and then working close with those institutions, decide what's needed to strengthen them. And then let me just mention on the challenges that we have to add to or elaborate on what Dirk and Larry's presented, some of the key challenges I see and how we might deal with them in an agency policy. We can't take on the whole of country systems. We have to focus. Is it in public financial management? Is it audit? Is it sector service delivery, decentralization? I think what we need to do as we come to a policy is we really need to make sure we prioritize according to our country development strategy and then make sure we harmonize with the government and with other donor plans. And I think we should consider some of the broad cross-cutting efforts like audit systems, public financial management. We also definitely need to accept that some other development partners know a lot more about things like public financial management than we do, and we need to be open to learning from their experience and working with them. Also, I think we can do a lot better on exit planning, especially where we plan to use country systems, put our resources into them so that we don't create dependencies. So as far as a policy, I would recommend that we require clear exit plans, and they need to be in close consultation with the institutions we're working with, and as necessary, maybe with the Ministry of Finance or Planning. Also, our emerging public financial management risk assessment framework is excellent. I think it gives us a new, very standardized way to assess and to design a risk management plan. It also recognizes that we need to commit to strengthening the institutions that we work with beyond just making them ready to get funding from the U.S. government. So that's good, but I think it's very focused on financial management. While we all know that some of the constraints to effective institutions go way beyond financial management. So I think that in our policy, we need to take an organizational development approach. I think we'll need organizational development skills on our staff or through international or local institutions. And I think for every system that we use, every local country system that we use, we should have a system strengthening plan associated with it, and one that's really broader than financial risk management. And then I guess I would conclude in coming back to what Dirk mentioned. It's very important here in Ghana. We, as a donor, tend to have, we tend to create parallel systems. And I think that when we have a policy, hopefully on country strengthening, I think we should explicitly say that we want to avoid the development of parallel systems. So I'll stop there. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you, Cheryl, and some really rich recommendations there, and to Bill, both of you, for staying late and providing that USAID perspective. I'd now like to turn to two of our other panelists, Emmy Simmons, who had a long career in USAID, several decades, and ended her career here in Washington as our Assistant Administrator for the Economic Growth and Agriculture and Trade Bureau. So we're very fortunate to have her. She's since leaving USAID dedicated her life to issues of poverty and partnership and hunger and agriculture in Africa specifically, but still very much part of the family, but providing a different perspective and I think some provocative thoughts. So I'll hand it over to Emmy.
I hope. Thanks, Susan. Thanks for inviting me to participate in this. When I first thought about it, I thought, gosh, you know, I have 40 years of experience now in the development business, and I can sort of really relate that, and then I realized I only had 8 minutes, so I'll try to be brief. What I thought I would focus on is kind of the outside of aid perspective. Often in USAID, we kind of focus on the mission and our partners and what's happening and organizations, etc., whereas, in fact, there's a whole world out there, and this has been one of my learnings in leaving aid, that, in fact, the world is bigger and more active and more evolutionary, I guess, than most of us had known. So let me just focus on sort of some of my comments and some of my experiences since the early 90s, which I think of as a very much of a watershed in terms of the development environment. When the Soviet Union collapsed, so did the possibility of really having state-owned and state-managed systems and having exchanges among people be done through non-market channels. So post-1990, approximately, the idea of the market, the idea of the private sector providing entrepreneurship, initiative, and investment, the idea of having people participate in government, all of these ideas, which USAID had been working with for many, many years, suddenly became more acceptable and, from a developing country perspective, kind of something that they really had to come to grips with. So during the 80s, there was a lot of pushback against structural adjustment and taking apart parastatal organizations and liberalizing markets, because everybody said, well, you know, I mean, the Soviet Union has all those things in place and it's doing fine. Well, after 1990, they could no longer say that the Soviet Union was doing fine, so the new model changed. So two basic sort of great big trends then kind of started rolling around the world after 1990, one being sort of globalization, as we understand it, with global trade, global information, global organizations, and the other one, what I'm going to call localization, which is not the same as it's been defined in the ODI paper, but effectively localization being the antidote that countries and communities put forward to sort of grapple with globalization. So globalization was new rules made by private markets, not by governments, the dominance of high-income countries complemented by a whole passel of rapidly growing middle-income countries. And just about that time, since Bill's on the line, India became part of that group, having perhaps not surprisingly in the early 90s decided to abandon some of its state-controlled mechanisms and to put a little bit more faith in the market. A whole bunch of new technology drivers kind of emerged onto the scene. While we had computers in the 1980s, cell phones really started in about 92, 93 to become perceived as something that was really going to change the technology of communication, very much part of the globalization. And there was an increasing focus on shared political values, democratization, the voice of citizens, the emergence of civil society as a concept which had a lot of sort of traction around the world. Localization, as the antidote to those things, really drove countries and communities to search for some kind of measure of more local control. As the world is changing, oh man, we've got to figure out how to sort of hold down on our own. There was a lot of emphasis on decentralization. During this era, I heard so much about the concept of subsidiarity, you know, mm-hmm. the European famous concept that things should be done at the level at which it is most appropriate to be done. Again, part of this, let's try to get control of what's happening to us. Communities looking for continued economic viability as urbanization really started to ramp up, first in China, but then also in India and other countries. But place-based solutions required effectively local solutions. And there were two things there, again, which I saw as emerging in the 1990s and sort of in the early 2000s. And those were extreme weather, which had huge impacts, floods, droughts, and civil conflict. That is unrest that turned into civil conflict within a country, not across the borders of countries. And effectively, what we found was that the old rules that enabled local management to actually sort of take charge locally were no longer working. So customary land tenure is my favorite example, because customary land tenure had worked for decades to sort of allocate land to people. Farmers had access to farms. But guess what? People started moving in. Demographic stress started to increase. People started moving around countries. Civil conflict led to large IDP population, internally displaced populations. And all of a sudden, those customary rules didn't work all that great. In addition, the new idea that was coming along here is that gender should, in fact, be paid attention to. Local communities, and in fact, many countries, did not have good rules about how gender, how women's role in society could be addressed and taken into account. So what we saw with these two, we as development people saw these two great huge forces which went way beyond USAID, involved lots and lots of people, but very much were integral to the work that USAID was trying to do. I believe that USAID helped to accelerate these trends. I believe that we had some people in USAID in the early 90s who were absolutely crucial to the extension of ICTs, telephone systems, mm-hmm. to the developing world. Juan Belt mm-hmm. did policy dialogue, he did economic analysis, he did arm twisting, and he did business development, and cell phones got into Latin America, Central America, before they got into a lot of places in the United States. And we also began, I think, to work very much more with countries to devise new governance structures, recognizing that globalization and localization couldn't be handled with just the old structures. We started to work on the notion of PPPs, mm-hmm. The public-private partnerships. I know one of my first, in the late 90s, getting involved in a public-private partnership with the Mars Corporation, making chocolate and cocoa mm-hmm. a really important focus for collaboration with USAID. So there was this recognition of a new balance of power between the public and the private sectors. Andrew Natsios, of course, when he came in, really sort of ramped this up with the Global Development Alliance, and this notion that the public and the private sector, both locally and globally, needed to somehow collaborate. And this was going beyond the country model to some extent. And I think that the newly announced new alliance, or not so new anymore, new alliance mm-hmm. for food security and nutrition, mm-hmm. you know, is just taking that tradition and pushing it one more step further. But of course, this whole big sort of roiling change really required not just new governance structures, but new capacities. And I think led us to this conversation that we're having today, recognizing that human capacities, financial capacities, organizational capacities needed, the old term used to be reform, but I think the politically correct strengthening of capacities is actually a heck of a lot better. But we also then, and this hasn't been mentioned so far, really spent a significant amount of time looking for ways to buffer the impact on losers, the people who did not work out, or that did not benefit from globalization, who did not benefit from localization, who were kind of pushed out. And basically, that whole effort, I think, led to some superb rethinking of the way that the U.S. supports emergency assistance, supports disaster recovery. And because Bill is on the line, I can't not say that in fact under his leadership and other leaders in DACHA, in OTI, in the CMM group, in the Food for Peace group, there's been a huge amount of movement toward working with those organizations, those country-based organizations, both civil society, religious, and government organizations that have started to really sort of make the concept of locally based safety nets a reality. And to mm-hmm. me, this is really mm-hmm. strength, the capacity strengthening of local systems. So all of this led, I believe, to us where we are today, and to some of the kind of lessons that both Cheryl and Bill kind of reiterated, as well as, I think, the Busan agenda. Effectively, this whole change of globalization and localization really led country leaders to step up their game and to step into the spotlight and say, yeah, we're in charge. Okay? I think that really happened. I also think, and this hasn't been mentioned so far, is that many low-income countries, many small countries recognized that they couldn't do it alone. And it's not just South-South, it's not just donor country, but it's also the development of regional partnerships, joining in regional organizations like COMESA, ASRECA, FARA, CADEP in Africa, mm-hmm. those are the ones that I know. That notion that, in fact, one needed to look not just to the traditional donors but to each other within a region to develop the kind of markets that would work, to develop the kind of governance structures that would make relationships across borders work, et cetera. But again, country leadership, regionalization, a little bit contradictory in terms of concepts. So there's, you know, there's something to say there. Okay, lessons. It seems to me over the last 20 years that what we've learned, and I think Dirk's presentation really brought this out, we need to think big, recognizing that globalization is upon us and will not stop. And we need to think small, recognizing that there are people who lose, that there are communities, as Cheryl pointed out, there are communities that need to sort of take responsibility for their own thing and be able to scale up their efforts to the national level. I also think one of the huge lessons is that, and this comes out in terms of talking about USAID as a learning organization, USAID thinking of itself as kind of generating, being a thought leader, is thinking about what the next generation of big trends that are going to wash over the world globally and are going to have very, very local impacts are going to be. I think food security, in my view, food security is still at the top of the list. I think for the next 30 years, there's going to be huge preoccupation with food insecurity. But I think climate change is also right up there at the top. And this is problematic for the United States because, in fact, the United States' position on climate change and its interaction with development opportunity is not as clear as it perhaps could be. I also believe that the issue of global inequities, which, did you mention that? I think it was on one of the things, and I didn't go through my notes. The issue of global inequity is going to really come to the fore in the next decade or two, because the matchup between people and resources and opportunities is way out of whack, right? We can say that, yes, indeed, you know, we're going to have better border controls, and so we're going to keep people out of the United States. But on the other hand, there are a lot of countries, Rwanda being one, for example, which is already overcrowded and which is now, you know, out there in public view as kind of saying, not only do we have a mismatch between our resources and our people, but we need more space. But we also have who has oil resources, who has mineral resources, and who does not. And the world's ability to deal with inter-country migration is pretty poor. The track record is pretty bad. Yet we all recognize the importance of remittances. I look at the microfinance community as having been kind of the first to recognize that remittances were an important part of reality. Urbanization. I'm running out of time. Ideas, innovation, the whole science challenge, technologies, the question of private ownership and managing that within this context, the whole question of natural resources. So I think that basically we need to sort of move away from the notion of development assistance to the whole concept of development cooperation, because the U.S. is a developing economy just like everybody else. We need to start mainstreaming global education, especially at the post-secondary level. And I think we really, really need to pay attention to PPPs, public-private partnerships, and how they figure into what we're calling here country system strengthening. Because I think that the discussion so far has been pretty much government to government, whereas in fact that PPP kind of system effectively is a way of much more aggressively bringing in the private sector.
Great. Thank you, Emmy, for using such a limited time so well, providing a really unique historical perspective, but I think some great lessons that will help guide us as we're developing the policy. So our last panelist I want to turn to before turning to all of you is Greg Adams, who we're so fortunate to have here as the director of Oxfam's America's advocacy work on aid effectiveness. Greg has really dedicated so much of his career to really the importance of aid effectiveness and how do we really deliver on development and really a long-term commitment to poverty in general, but also the work at Oxfam that has been just so instrumental, I think, at least to us here in USAID as we've been developing our work in this area. So I'll hand it over to Greg now.
Thanks so much, and I'll try to live up to that billing. I'm actually very honored to be on a panel with people I've worked with and respected for a long time, and especially happy to see Dirk here, who's been a longtime partner on back when I was on the Hill and and most recently at Busan, fighting the good fight, trying to put these principles into practice. I wanted to talk specifically, I think, about the frame we're using. And I apologize, in a conversation that I think is rightly framed about technical questions and a search for hard evidence and results that can inform USAID policy, I want to step back a little bit and look a little bit at the frame that's being used, especially in light of one of the key pieces of data that Larry brought in, that USAID actually has a growing and relatively new, comparatively, workforce. There are, of course, a lot of old veterans around who have a host of experience. But you are, to some degree, you are building a new agency and building a new culture and engaging in a new enterprise here. And I think that cultural aspect of this is important, and specifically in the language that USAID is using around country system strengthening. I think what gets lost a little bit in that and has the potential to get lost in our conversation here is the fact that USAID does not strengthen country systems. Oxfam doesn't strengthen country systems. Many of us here in this room don't actually do that work. People on the ground do that work because those systems actually become stronger and deliver the way we want when they are accountable to people in their own country. And this is the political trap that you know, bears repeating, even though we all know it. We spend so much time working on USAID's accountability in this town that distracts us from the clear mission, which is trying to support the emergence of states and societies which are accountable to and deliver for their own people. And I think it's important, though, to get our language right on this and keep reminding ourselves that actually we're not doing this work. The best we can hope is that we're supporting people in these countries who are doing it themselves. But I think that speaks to Dirk's big point in his presentation, that people are doing this. There is a heck of a lot of capacity out there, and there are people more and more who are using the access that they have, be it some of the technical innovations that Emmy has talked about, or even the changes in the way that we approach the problems of development, to take advantage of those opportunities and actually invest in the capacity of their country to solve its development challenges. I think this speaks to another point that Dirk had, which was the focus on money often diverts attention from results. We tend to default to counting money because you can see it and count it. And it's often, as we all know, not the most meaningful measurement of how well a system is working or how well it's delivering. We're obviously not going to get away from counting the dollars, because ultimately a lot of our stakeholders expect us to count the dollars. But we can supplement that with other more meaningful measures. Just a point even from Dirk's PowerPoint. When Dirk puts up a chart from CABRI, which is a rightly respected organization because of the hard work that they do and the great work that they do. When Dirk puts up a chart from CABRI at a conference here in Washington, he's using country systems. Mm-hmm. And it comes from a basis of respect and an understanding of the value that actually exists in a lot of these countries. And that's really the core competency that I think USAID needs to build out. Again, not saying that there aren't hardworking people at USAID who see it as their job to do this every day, but if there's a core competency that needs to be honed and expanded, it's the ability to identify value locally and ramp that up. Now, that sounds easy in principle when I say it. It's actually hard in practice, because when you're investing in helping local people establish their own value, establish their own identity, and take credit for the work that they're doing, we oftentimes view this as a zero-sum game. And this isn't just about USAID. We all know about the branding requirements imposed by Congress and all the other rules that make this difficult for USAID. It's a lot of times part of our business model, either on the nonprofit or the for-profit side, as implementing partners, in that we often feel the need to take credit for things that we rightly should be giving credit to our local partners for. And we need to find a way to do that more. Again, I don't want to diminish that people aren't already doing this. but it's still one of the core challenges here, and it's the thing that we need to press harder on if we're actually going to support that the emergence of the local leaders who are actually going to solve these challenges. But one of the things we did also talked about was this distinction between strengthening country systems and using country systems. And while I think it's a useful distinction in terms of parsing out our work, it's ultimately one that can divert us, I think, from what the ultimate goal is. And that again comes down to this point of how you actually establish the strength of that system, how you measure it, and what some of the more qualitative measurements are. If we as the United States government spend a lot of time investing in trying to help local people strengthen their systems, and we're giving them advice and technical expertise and helping them hone these systems in the way that we supposedly as experts on this issue think they should be honed, and then we refuse to use those systems, you're undermining the strengthening effort. So while I think from an analytical standpoint we do need to separate out strengthening and use, from a practical standpoint, we cannot separate them out. If we are supporting the strengthening of systems and we believe we are successful with that, and then we are afraid to use those systems, we're afraid to actually trust those local partners to do their work and use those systems and work the kinks out and figure out how those systems actually adapt to their context, we're not finishing the job. So I think we need to make sure that we're not taking that distinction too far. Maybe the last point I'll end on here is something that I heard many years ago from a civil society activist in Liberia. It was 2006. It was shortly after the election where Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was elected and Liberia finally looked like it was starting to get on the right path. And he was commenting on, the civil society activist was commenting on the efforts the donors were making to try to solve the huge accountability deficit that existed in Liberia and had helped fuel the civil war there. And what he said was, the donors are focused on helping us build beautiful systems of integrity, and yet we don't have enough of a focus on building a constituency for accountability. So these things go hand in hand. Again, if we're focused on trying to help local leaders and government strengthen systems, but we're not actively investing, on the other point, on trying to help citizens actually demand that those systems work and deliver results for them, we're leaving the loop incomplete. And again, we're making a false distinction in our work. You have to complete that loop, or you're not actually going to get the results. Just one more anecdote I'll add on this point. I recently, when I was in Paris for the final Busan meetings back in June, I met a guy from the Philippines who was a longtime civil society activist who had campaigned for more transparency and accountability in budgeting within the Philippine government. And their campaign had actually been successful, and they had got the new incoming Filipino government to change their systems and create an office that was responsible for engaging with local civil society, engaging them in the budgeting process. And he had been hired away from civil society to come into government to run this office. And I asked him how it was going, and he said, it's really tough, because while we created the system in government, now civil society lacks the capacity to really grapple with these issues, to understand what's going on, and engage with us effectively, because we've got all the technical tools at our disposal, and they don't. And there's this huge deficit in terms of their actual ability to engage. Tom Carruthers over at Carnegie has I think done some very useful writing and speaking on the subject to remind us that this doesn't happen magically. You know, yes, there are people out there who are working in their communities trying to hold their governments accountable, but it doesn't happen magically. It requires sustained investment. We're blessed here in the United States to have a model where we've basically, for the most part, got a self-supporting, independent civil society that has been part of the core of our republic for almost 400 years now. That same tradition is different in other countries. It doesn't work the way it does here. And if we really want to make sure that citizens are able to organize in the ways that they need to hold governments accountable, we need to actually work over a sustained period of time, over decades, to make sure that comes out. I think the U.S. has a strong track record on this, actually, in certain cases, of being able to make this work. But there are too many places where we fail to do it well, and that's one of the things we need to focus on to complete the loop.
Great. Thanks, Greg, for really bringing this panel to a close. I think there were some real common themes that we heard throughout, starting from Bill to Cheryl to Emmy to Greg, about how hard this is, as Greg really, I think, just so vividly described in a couple of country situations, as Bill said, it's a long-term commitment, and leadership is important, and not just often as we think about host country government leadership in a community, searching out for those reformers. And as Cheryl and Emmy, I think, so appropriately highlighted, the importance of looking outside of our comfort zone and outside of our normal networks, whether you're within USAID or within another institution. And one of the issues that seems to be swirling about all morning is this issue of definition. We talk about country system strengthening, and is strengthening enough, building up the management systems or using those systems in order to actually strengthen them in order to achieve better development? So I open the floor to all of you to ask any questions or comments that you may have at this time, as well as online. You have a question online? Let's start with them, since they've been waiting.
This question comes from David Hess, development consultant. His question is for Emmy and anyone else. In the new paradigm that you described with globalization, localization, and regionalization, you described, is U.S.-style democracy still a relevant model to promote? Thinking of Rwanda, for example, haven't the economic and social improvements there, including major gender advances, illustrates that U.S. democracy may not be a required component?
Okay, I'll let Emmy take that one. As others.
I think the answer is yes. I mean, I think the U.S. has a lot of experience in our own evolving democratic systems, having to do with how young people, for example, I mean, we've all just been through this election process, how young people participate, how they do it differently, how one can use new media, social media, new technologies to actually engage people in the process of voting, how one can use new organizational types, civil society, to generate the kind of discussion that underpins democratic choice and actually makes the democracy not just an every X year election process, but sort of an ongoing and continuing part of how a society works. I mean, Greg perhaps has something more to say on that.
I'll maybe say a little bit more. I think, the answer, should we be promoting a model of U.S.-style democracy, I think the answer is no. I think we've tried that, and there are some clear lessons as to what the limitations of that are. But there are some values that we have that are clear and immutable, and I don't think we should shy away from promoting those as a development community. Things like it's right for women to be able to hold property and have standing in a court of law. It is right for people with disabilities to be able to participate in their communities and not be shunned or isolated. It is right for people to have the same opportunities regardless of their station of birth or place of birth or ethnicity. But I think we get hung up a lot of times, again, and this is this distinction between systems of integrity and constituency for accountability a little bit. We get hung up on the forms rather than the outcomes. And I think one of the key things that USAID can do better on is modeling the process of democratic accountability. There's some very real legislative constraints, but also some regulatory constraints that I think the agency can change in terms of how it responds to local civil society, the access it provides, and being able to demonstrate clear places where U.S. policy in a country has changed because of demands from local civil society or even from, you know, reasonably accountable government officials. So, you know, sometimes it would help, I think, if USAID said, you know what, we're changing because you asked us to change and being clear about that. One of the things we've found in the recent field research we've done is that, you know, over 80% of the people that we spoke to in local civil society say they see the U.S. changing, being more responsive to local concerns. And yet they're not quite sure how the feedback loop gets closed. They see things are changing, but they don't have an understanding about how they've actually been able to impact that. And I think if the agency could be a little bit more explicit abroad of, we changed this because you asked us to, it could help model that behavior, and then they start asking the same questions about, hey, why isn't our government doing that?
Great points. And I'd like to ask Larry to respond because he and a team in USAID have really been diving into this very deeply.
Just two quick points. First of all, on Greg's point about modeling behavior, I mean, I 100% agree, but I think we need to caveat that a bit, that, you know, when we talk about modeling accountability, I mean, part of our accountability is, you know, responding to the rules and regulations that exist. Many of us don't necessarily like those rules as they affect us in our development day-to-day world, but you know, that's part of our democratic accountability system, that, you know, Congress makes the laws, even some of them that we find quite problematic. And I think modeling that, explaining to our counterparts that that is our system, that, you know, we may disagree, we may even think it's, you know, not consistent with some of the principles that we subscribe to internationally, but that we have an obligation to abide by those rules is also the other side of the democratic accountability. And then to the question, I mean, I agree that, we need to look at a country like Rwanda and what it is delivering to its people, but I also think that we do, as Greg said, need to reflect on some of our core values, and how we balance those, is tricky in many cases, is challenging in many cases, but we can't ignore those realities, both from a political perspective, but I think ultimately from a longer term development perspective. And so, Rwanda does pose, some, issues for us, and so having visited there several months ago, appreciate it. I mean, the country has done an incredible job of moving forward from, a horrific genocide, less than two decades ago. But that doesn't mean that, we can, say, okay, we ignore everything else that goes on in that society that may be inconsistent with some of those core values that we subscribe to.
Okay, great. We have a few more minutes before lunch, so I'd like to take several questions, please, and we'll...
Harry Diener from Mercy Corps. I was really struck by Bill's comment about the wake-up call he received in India on the need to look beyond the usual suspects in terms of partnerships. And I'd be really interested in hearing the panel's perspective on that comment and ideas and thoughts that you have on how the new policy could address that issue.
Okay, great. Chip, did you?
Now, the point I wanted to make was sort of to make a bridge between what Larry was just saying and what Greg was saying earlier, because I think one of the things that we have learned from our own experiences looking back, and it was rooted in the World Development Report that came out in 2004 about improving service delivery to the poor, is the fact that accountability, both in terms of accountability of direct service recipients as well as vertical ones, are essential parts of how you build the results that you want to achieve. And so being concerned about building accountability and wanting to see results are two sides of exactly the same point. And indeed, some of the work that we were doing with the DAC and service delivery in fragile states and so forth really emphasized this point. So I don't think that focusing on accountability and focusing on is incompatible with a desire for results. And indeed, our recent assessment that we did in Rwanda was saying that they have pushed the envelope as far as they can probably go in terms of top-down requirements, and if they really want to make any further progress beyond this, they really do have to start thinking about how to bring local-level accountability back into the equation, which they hadn't up till then.
Great. Thanks, Chip. Any other questions, comments?
Yes, please.
Have a couple. And then online, we have a couple others.
Okay, my name is Suzanne Bontins. I'm with Deloitte Consulting, and the question will be directed towards Cheryl. I hope you're still on the phone, Cheryl. One thing that I'm happy to hear is a little bit more appreciation for what exists already on the ground with institutions. At the end of the day, capacity development is about change, organizational change fundamentally, and then change around those organizations as well. Unfortunately, what often happens is that through, and I see a change in USAID with the HICD approach, but overall, when there's tax administration reform work to be done, RFPs are asking for tax administration experts. Tax administration experts are not usually organizational development people, whereas the crux of what needs to happen, usually the way we operate is through organizations. They're our partners. So I applaud the change with HICD, but at the same time, we need to see, as a policy, I think for development practitioners and for the Deloittes of the world and the other Beltway Bandits that are there, we must respond to the RFPs as they're written. And when RFPs are written, where your key staff, key personnel are tax administration reform people, yet you expect change in those organizations beyond the technical change, and you're expecting change to stick. When we bring in tax administration, I have no problems with tax administration folks, by the way. but when we bring in those people, first, they're not likely to be appreciative. They're more likely to bring in their experience in other countries or best practices, rather than looking at what works and building on what works. For every organization, we're all a little quirky, we all do things differently, and there are things that work in each organization. It's unlikely, given the way the RFPs are written, and therefore the way we're prodded to respond to them, and you know, each organization is trying to squeak out as many points as possible, so we're echoing back what we hear. What we'd like to hear is that you want change to happen, and typically there'd be organizational development people involved in that change and maybe leading that change. So the question is to Cheryl, how is it that you're able, you had identified that you need more organizational development skills on staff. How are you making that happen, and is it actually coming out in terms of the RFPs that are coming out of the mission?
Thank you for that concrete recommendation, maybe in the back, and then we'll take a couple online.
Thank you. Just a couple of
Hello?
Comments, honestly. Can you hear me?
One moment, Cheryl. We're going to take maybe one more question, then go to the answers.
A couple of comments. The first one about the public-private partnerships, and my sense that we are misnaming things and avoiding the politics, the hard politics of what that means. To what degree does that really, in a way, hide the fact that the states have lost the control of the private sector, the large global private sector, and in talking about it as a partnership, really just saying, well, they're already so powerful on their own that we cannot have governance over them. And does that in a way, you might say, hide the fact that there is a big, major global governance issue that would need to be addressed just at the same time as we're talking about development? The second point is one that, as a foreigner in the U.S., strikes me. When thinking about USAID, and I look at this room, who in the U.S. has the most experience with the perverse resistance of institutions to change, and at the same time has been most able to, over the long run, make change that actually is significant? And I say it's the African-American community. And yet I look at us here, and I think about my experience with USAID. what has been done about using that experience in the way we do development. I like very much the expression of it's about development assistance, it's about development cooperation, and that's the part of the U.S. that is about learning to develop. And yet I see so little and have seen so little use of it over the years that I have had some relationship to USAID. I think there's some issues to think about there in terms of change. Thanks.
Thank you for that. So let's turn to Cheryl. I hear you're still on the line, and to really have you address two points, if we may. I think the first is Bill talked about getting beyond the usual suspects, and just to hear from your perspective, not only in Ghana but other places. I think all of us up here on the podium could share examples of how we've had to do that, the challenges with having to do that. And then I think a really appropriate point about how do you really address organizational culture, change management expertise. And, you know, one thing as we dive into this often very technical subject area, we try and always bring it back to that development is about human beings, and it's ultimately about organizational and greater change within a society. And so just to hear your perspective on that. Over to you, Cheryl.
Hello?
There you go.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not hearing from the audience very well, so I hope I've understood the questions well. Let me talk about the point about needing different kind of skill sets, and I think the point is well taken that we have to think very carefully if we are doing solicitations. We have to think very carefully about the actual skills that we need, and we're learning. We're trying to get more feedback on the solicitations before we put them out in final, and we listen to that feedback very carefully, and I think as we go along, we're learning more about the kinds of skill sets that we need. I would also like to add that hopefully we are going to be able to find some of the skills in organizational development and organizational change management locally, and we will probably be looking to some of our international partners to help develop those skills locally.
Great, thank you for that. Dirk, do you want to talk a little bit about sort of looking beyond the usual suspects and what that means?
Yeah, I think both Cheryl and Bill mentioned that, and I want to just put it on a slightly different way. It's happening, and it's happening by the partner countries. I think my example from how many other developing countries visited Georgia for answers is an example of that. And I think it's happening because other countries are having success. Brazil has had success, as I mentioned, in reducing income inequality to some degree. And they have a much more proactive interventionist approach on directing companies in hiring and firing and investing than we would be comfortable with doing in the United States. It doesn't make it right, it doesn't make it wrong, but it's a different approach that people want to understand. And you can see that also going inside of things. In Europe and the United States, cash transfer programs haven't really worked out that well. But for some reason, it's working out well in Mexico. What India is doing is a whole body of experience that, frankly, is outstripping what we've been seeing in Latin America on the use of cash transfers. There are other sets of practices. What I'm saying is it's happening, and we need to join that effort. And I think one of the real opportunities here, and I think Japan is doing an excellent job on this, is what we're all calling triangular cooperation. It's recognizing that there are things certain countries can do better than we can, and we can all learn from it. So when Uganda wanted to do performance auditing, some of the traditional donors said, no, it's too sophisticated for you. And Japan said, well, you know, India's doing it. Why don't we send you to India and see how they do it and see if it makes sense? And they did. And they are doing more performance auditing in Uganda. And they are catching some of the problems. Maybe some of the donors are still reacting the wrong way by cutting off programs. But I think it's happening. And I think it's a challenge for us to get on board with it, as, if you will, some of the traditional donors, and just really seize it. Because nobody's waiting for us. It's happening.
And Bill, if you're still on the line and still awake, do you want to comment at all about the last question regarding, or comment regarding, the role of the private sector and globalization? Clearly, the work you're doing in India there, very non-traditional, and how you bring them in, and also how you reconcile some of the challenges about whether or not that truly represents the society as you're working towards reform. We lost Bill.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, great, Bill. We thought we lost you. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I had to switch to the phone. I think what we're struggling with here is Indian businesses, especially the 50-plus Indian billionaires from the last few decades and others, are setting up foundations. And part of it is a very CSR approach. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is trying to find businesses who are interested in getting engaged in kind of different types of approaches for reaching the bottom of the pyramid in India and elsewhere. That's really part of their business model. And whether it's market-based partnerships or the like, and it's not easy, because a lot of the businesses that do the traditional PPPs are thinking CSR. And not part of their, so it's not that sustainable in that sense. But it's a good point what he raised, and I think here we're working with both small and large businesses, but increasingly what we're talking to them about is putting, again, money on the table, and where mm-hmm. we can find other partners with common development objectives, and especially where they see, you know, actually part of their business process reaching out to especially rural India.
Great. Thank you for that. And maybe just to conclude, if Greg or Emmy want to comment, particularly on this important point about diversity and development cooperation and reframing from development assistance to actually development cooperation, and how you create that whole of society approach to that.
The exactly how that's going to work and how it should work is way beyond what I can kind of summarize in a very short period of time, because I think there's a tremendous amount of experimentation and a tremendous amount of kind of testing going on as to how that would work. And what Bill just said I think was relevant, looking at sort of companies not just as sources of funding that one can leverage and therefore accepting CSR, but purposefully looking for companies to partner with who are bringing their own money to the table, but for whom this is a sustainable business interest, pursuing a goal that is very much shared by USAID. This is all still a work in progress, but to me this is where development cooperation mm-hmm. is going. Government to government is critical and important. Working with civil society, absolutely. But also the whole sort of public-private collaboration, all built in around sort of these common development goals. And I think, you know, as I said, food security is a biggie. Coping with climate change is a biggie. Figuring out how we're going to manage inequity, a biggie. And so just one approach isn't going to do it. I mean, we're going to really need all the tools in the toolbox and probably a whole lot that we haven't even thought about developing so far.
Great. Thanks. Greg?
As Emmy said, I won't take the time, I think, to map this all out, nor could I. I do want to kind of echo her point, but just say that, you know, as you I think the move towards triangular cooperation is terrific. I think it's good to have a more sophisticated approach towards public-private partnerships that, again, as Emmy said, are focused more on what companies already want to invest in and figuring out what how that's sustainable over the long term and what maybe some of the barriers are and how those can be overcome. But the caution is, I think, to make this really work and get to the point of accountability, you need to bring in additional partners. You do need to have, like, if you're doing a public-private partnership, there needs to be a voice for local civil society at the table to make sure that you're not just gutting important safeguards. If you're working on a triangular cooperation project with another government, you need to bring in other stakeholders to make sure that that's actually delivering the kind of results that you want to deliver. That makes it a heck of a lot more complicated because we'd all like to reduce the number of interlocutors we have because that makes the conversation a lot more simple. But it's, I think we have to accept that to make these things work, you need to bring a vast array of stakeholders to the table.
Great. Well, thank you. Please join me in thanking our panelists from around the world. I hope Bill and Cheryl can hear the applause as well. We really appreciate you and your team staying up late and for all our panelists here. I think the logistics I will probably hand over to Chip or someone maybe. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you very, very much, Susan. Wonderfully productive kickoff to our 2 days of work together. We're going to break for lunch. It's outside here by the other side of the registration, and we're going to reconvene at 12:45. Look forward to seeing you then.
Tell us what we're doing at 12:45.
Right. Yeah. That's it. Oh, surprise. No, it's your intent. Come on. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah. 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 Ye